Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, it is. It's flying fast and furious. Whether it's JonBenet Ramsey's death or whether it's... Really, I think the big story here is this suit challenging George W. Bush's Spy on Americans program that he calls his, terrorist surveillance program, his illegal violation of the law, frankly. I mean, the FISA law, the Foreign Intelligence Security Act, was passed by Congress in the wake of Richard Nixon's abuses and said specifically, President can't do this. If he wants to spy on Americans, that's fine, but you have to get a warrant. It's just like, you know, if they want to kick in the door of your house, that's the government has the power to do that, but they have to get a warrant. And this isn't just some, like, random thing that somebody came up with. I mean, it's not just, hey, well, this would be a good idea. It's not like that at all. This goes back to the Constitution. The Fourth Amendment to the Constitution says the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. And no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the person or things to be seized. In other words, you have to, if you're in the executive branch of government, we have three branches of government. Legislative, which is the House and the Senate, the executive, which is the president, and the judicial, which is the Supreme Court and all the other federal courts and you know, on down. And primarily the Supreme Court and the federal district courts. And bottom line, as a way of separating out powers so that you have a somewhat adversarial system in government, so that one branch of government can watch another branch and make sure that they're not, you know, misbehaving. If the executive branch, which runs the police powers of the United States, the FBI, the NSA, the CIA, all of that stuff is under the president. It's funded by Congress, so the Congress has the power of the purse, but there's, you know, large chunks of it that are actually kept secret from Congress. You know, there's these black box budgets. I mean, there's some members of Congress who have access to some of that information, but the bottom line is that if the executive branch wants to spy on us, the law says unambiguously they have to get a warrant. It doesn't mean that they can't spy on us. I mean, the cons have been out there trying to spin this thing as,
well, anybody who opposes the terrorist surveillance program doesn't want us to be able to listen in and catch terrorists.
No, that's not true. We all want the FBI, the CIA, the NSA to be able to listen in and catch terrorists. All of us. I've never heard a single person say they don't think that any of these groups should be able to spy on people. We just want them to do it legally. We are a nation of laws. We have this thing called due process in the United States. And now it looks like this is the breaking story. It looks like a decision may be coming down as a consequence of a lawsuit filed by the Electronic Freedom Foundation. And this is being reported, oddly enough, by Fox News, that a federal district court in Detroit is ruling or has ruled that the Bush administration's NSA warrantless wiretapping program is unconstitutional. If so, expect to see a whole lot of spinning coming out of this administration. As they note over at the thinkprogress.org blog, which is the first place I've seen to report this, they say the court had previously rejected the administration's argument that the court could not hear the case due to state secrets. Right? You get this? Originally, the Bush administration said to the federal district court, we know that we're supposed to go to you guys to get warrants before we spy on people, but we're not doing that. We're breaking the law. And we know that if somebody breaks the law, then they're supposed to go before a court to for it to be determined whether or not they're breaking the law. But we can't come before you. We won't allow ourselves to come before you, or you don't have the right to bring us before you to determine whether we're breaking the law, because the process by which we're breaking the law is a state secret. And because it's a state secret, and the state is just the executive branch, you and the judicial branch, you have no right to know about it. That's basically been the Bush administration's argument. The lawsuit alleged that the NSA program violates both the First and Fourth Amendments, our freedom of speech and our right to privacy, as well as a number of federal statutes, including the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the FISA Act. That's the law that says that, yeah, fine, no problem. You can spy on people. You just have to get a court order. And, in fact, we're going to make it easy for you. We're going to set up a special court, a brand-new special court, a FISA court. And you can go before that court. So, anyhow, that's the breaking news right now. Welcome to the program. 11 minutes after the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Glad to have you with us. This is it's going to be interesting to see how this thing shakes out. Today, by the way, Congressman John Conyers, assuming that there's not a vote or something that interrupts his ability to be with us, will be with us at the bottom of this hour. In our second hour, Steven Slavinsky is going to be with us. He's the author of a Republican, author of a book, Buck Wild, How Republicans Broke the Bank and Became the Party of Big Government. He's a conservative. He's actually the director of budget studies at the Cato Institute. I shouldn't say he's a Republican. I should say he's, in all probability, a libertarian. We'll find out. And Brad Friedman is going to be with us in the third hour talking about voting news. There's a whole bunch of stuff going on with regard to electronic voting and just the, you know, the general destruction of voting in the United States. And at 20 minutes past the third hour, it would be 11:20 on the West Coast. It would be 2:20 on the East Coast. Carol Porter will be with us. She's running for Congress in New Hampshire's 1st District, our Taking Our Country Back segment. So, but this thing with the Bush administration, this is a big one. This is a big one. The other thing that's obviously going to dominate the news, and in fact, this is really an interesting juxtaposition. The other thing that's obviously going to dominate the news is the arrest of this guy and the killing of JonBenet Ramsey, the 6-year-old girl who was murdered in Boulder, Colorado, 10 years ago, and he's been arrested in Thailand and apparently has confessed and said that he was there, that it was an accident, he was actually just trying to kidnap her, or, you know, words to that effect. Gee, we're reassured, right? But what this highlights is two things. Number one, that it's going to be a wall-to-wall, all missing little white girl story day, right? I mean, you know, it's whether it's the missing white girl in Aruba or whether it's JonBenet Ramsey, the mainstream media is going to go on a feed frenzy with this story, which means that the Bush administration knows that people will be paying attention to nothing else but that, and the news media won't be paying attention to anything else. So this would be the perfect day, for example, for the administration to announce that they've lost in court on the terrorist surveillance program. This would be the perfect day for bad news about the Bush administration to come out, because it won't get reported. So expect, I mean, I've been sitting here all morning waiting for the other shoe to drop. What is it going to be that the Bushies are going to, you know, allow to get out into the media that maybe even Fox News will break? What's the story that maybe even Fox News would break? Because it's just something that they'd rather we didn't know about, and so they'll break it at the time that everybody else is talking about JonBenet Ramsey. Well, it looks like it may well be the fact that the Bush administration has lost, the federal court has said, no, what you're doing is unconstitutional. You are breaking the law, George W. Bush. And if he's breaking the law, I mean, that means he's committed a high crime or misdemeanor, which means he could be impeached today, the perfect day to release that news. And then secondly, the other part of the JonBenet Ramsey story, I think, that we should keep in mind is that her parents were essentially tried and convicted in the court of public opinion by the media in this country, of having something to do with her disappearance and death. And now here comes this guy who apparently did it. Again, you know, he's innocent until proven guilty. But the point is, you know, this rush to judgment. We saw the same thing with Richard Jewell, the guy who was the security guard down in Atlanta, who they said was the terrorist who bombed the folks in Atlanta at the Olympics. Turns out it was actually a Christian terrorist. Remember that guy? He was, you know, bombing abortion clinics, killing abortion doctors, blew up a bomb, a Christian terrorist. It wasn't Richard Jewell. Or Mr. Yi, the Muslim minister, the pastor, the cleric, the army chaplain, who was charged with supplying secrets to the enemy down in Guantanamo. It turns out he was innocent. He was tried in the court of public opinion. So, you know, a cautionary tale, something we can learn from Canada.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Here's the news, coming to you every hour on the hour. The weather's fine, but there may be a meteor shower.
And welcome back, Exposing the Con in Conservative. Tom Hartman here with you. This could be a huge story. In terms of democracy, in terms of the United States, if these initial Fox News reports, and isn't it odd that Fox News is, as far as we can tell, David's scrubbing the websites. He looked over at CNN.com and you've checked out thinkprogress.org is the place that is reporting that Fox News is reporting. They have a picture of it, the Fox News alert, federal judge, Bush warrantless, surveillance unconstitutional. That Fox News is reporting that the Bush administration has gone to court and been slapped down. This is the case that originally was brought by the Electronic Freedom Foundation against AT&T. For participating in Bush's program. And now the federal government has been dragged into the thing. Back on July 20th, U.S. District Judge Vaughn Walker had said to the Bush administration, sorry, you can't use the state secrets thing to stop this case from going forward. Can't do it. Now, in Rasul versus Bush and in Hamdan versus Rumsfeld, two other cases where the Bush administration ultimately lost on their way up to the Supreme Court, in both those cases, the Bush administration tried to say, the courts don't have any jurisdiction here. This is a state secret. I mean, that's how Hitler ran Germany. That's how Mussolini ran Italy. That's how Franco ran Spain. That's not how the United States does business. It's how the Bush administration would like to do business. But no, it's not how we do it here. And Judge Walker, by the way, the guy who said, sorry, you know, state secrets doesn't wash. I will quote him. He said, the compromise between liberty and security remains a difficult one, but dismissing this case at the outset would sacrifice liberty for no apparent enforcement of security. And no, he is not some, you know, wacko liberal on the courts, as I'm sure they're going to try and portray him. But no, I'm sorry. He was appointed by Bush Sr. to the federal court and is considered a conservative in the legal community. Steve Aftergood of the Federation of American Scientists. I'm quoting an article by Nat Hentoff in the Washington Times. Steve Aftergood of the Federation of American Scientists points out in his valuable secrecy news blog, FAS.org, Judge Walker's rare act of constitutional independence is especially noteworthy since the government's state secrets silencer is so often successful. Says Mr. Aftergood, quote, although the assertion of the state secrets privilege has only been denied by judges on at least four occasions, those denials seem to have been based on technical defects or procedural failings rather than substantial judicial assessment of the merits. In other words, the Bush administration more often than not gets away with this kind of thing. And you know, thank goodness that this court is standing up and saying no. But, of course, a story about the Bush administration breaking the law and being found to be in violation of the law and the Constitution by a federal court would, you would guess, gee, what a surprise, be released on the day that the killer of JonBenet Ramsey is busted. Surprise, surprise. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Is it Parviz in Larchmont, New York?
Hi, Tom.
Hey,
it's a pleasure talking to you. You're my hero. You know, what I want to say is that the War Crimes Act, that the Bush administration is going after it because he's afraid that the Democrats are going to take power and they're going to prosecute him and Cheney and all the other people who have rendered, who have tortured, who have carried this war with lies, with a pack of lies. And they are making us less secure by planning the Lebanon attack beforehand because, you know, Hezbollah was capturing these soldiers according to the interview that
this is really an entire separate thing that I haven't even ranted about, which is the War Powers Act. The Bush administration is trying to take down the law under which they could be prosecuted for the kinds of things that they've been doing.
Exactly what I was trying to say, the illegal war in Lebanon by Israel, which is illegal, is against the resolution number
1665.
251.
Okay.
Not resolution. Article number 251, which says you have to go to war when you're at imminent danger of being overrun. And there's no other options, absolutely no other options. And Israelis had options of exchanging those prisoners. So they acted illegally with the cooperation with U.S. So the Bush administration is so scared of the War Crimes Act because they are war criminals in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and in Beirut, Lebanon.
Yeah. I'll go for Iraq for sure, Parviz. As far as Israel and Lebanon, I frankly, honestly don't know the legality of that war. And so I'm right smack dab in the middle on that one. I'm waiting for the judge, you know, the jury to come in, as it were. But we should be looking into that. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And Bush, you know, listening in to your phone calls and reading your email and wanting to know what websites you're looking at and all that sort of thing. That's making it his business. Welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. This now, the Wall Street Journal reporting, a federal judge in Detroit has ruled that the Bush administration's warrantless surveillance program violates the Constitution. The case was brought by the American Civil Liberties Union against the National Security Agency. The ACLU argued that the domestic surveillance program violates the rights to free speech and privacy. A judge ordered an immediate halt to the wiretapping program. U.S. District Judge Anna Diggs Taylor in Detroit became the first judge to strike down the NSA's program, which she says violates the rights to free speech and privacy. It doesn't get any more unambiguous than that. George W. Bush knocked down. 1-866-440-8466. In just a few minutes, I believe John Conyers is going to be with us. Right now, Harry in Fort Myers, Florida, on the line. Hey, Harry, thanks for calling the program. What's up?
Okay. First of all, I love the show.
Thank you.
But I really want to take umbrage at that last caller who was defending the Muslims' actions against Israel and saying that Israel broke international law when, you know, you've got to realize that every second of every minute of every day, they're in a defensive posture because they are under attack by 1.2 billion Muslims worldwide.
Well, I'm not sure I would go along with Harry, I'm on your side. I'm not sure I'd go along with 1.2 billion Muslims worldwide, but there are countries in the region that are still in a state of war with Israel. Absolutely. I agree with you.
And Hezbollah, which is basically an arm of Ahmed Dinejad in Iran.
Possibly, yeah. It's also the problem that I think Israel is facing, that we're facing, and that Lebanon is facing, is that the Lebanese army is now going to occupy southern Lebanon, right?
Right.
The majority of the, and probably all, but let's say the majority of the Hezbollah, quote, guerrillas, end quote, are actually Lebanese who live in South Lebanon. Now,
right.
What's the army made up of? Lebanese citizens. So,
right.
If there's not a political solution, my point is that if there's not a political solution in that region, no military solution is going to make them secure.
Oh, I totally agree. But for this guy to have said that they were breaking international law.
Yeah, well, that's where I said I don't know that that's true, and I don't, okay. Harry,
thanks, Tom. I appreciate what you do.
Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. In my mind, whether Israel broke the law or not is not as big an issue as whether they really just, screwed things up for themselves. But that's, the jury is still out on that, too. Congressman John Conyers is with us. Congressman Conyers, welcome to the program.
Tom Hartman, it's a pleasure to be on your radio show because you examine the issues currently in great detail.
Well, thank you, sir, and it's an honor to have you on the program. You are one of my heroes, one of the finest members of the United States House of Representatives, and this new minority report that has just been released is extraordinary over your signature, and it comes, perhaps you've heard the news, a federal judge in Detroit just...
Yes, Judge Anna Diggs Taylor.
Yeah, just found out
that the... wiretap activities of the National Security Agency were illegal and unconstitutional, and that they should be ended immediately. It was a very strong, unwavering kind of decision, which I'm very proud came out of the Eastern District Court of Michigan.
Now, Congressman Conyers, you're an attorney. Tell me if I have this right. If a judge tells me that I've broken the law, that's usually in the context of, and therefore you're going to jail. It's like, if a judge tells me that I've broken the law, then I'm a criminal. If this judge is telling George W. Bush that he's broken the law, is she not also at least implicitly saying that he has, I mean, he's broken the law?
He is subject to all of the penalties for breaking that law.
Right, and what are those penalties? This would be under the FISA Act, right?
Well, under the FISA Act, there's probably a criminal sentence involved. It's a criminal law, and fines as well. But as you know, this is just the beginning of it because you mentioned my report that's just out, which is 370 pages of covering the Iraq debacle from where it began before it began, and warrantless wiretapping in the United States. It covers both these areas. And it took so long, Mr. Hartman, to finally get it wrapped up because every week there's a new development. Today, here's a new development. A federal district court judge hearing this case brought by the American Civil Liberties Union feels that this law has, the FISA law has been broken and is not being lived up to, which is precisely what the administration claimed was not the case, that they had extraordinary powers, since the president is the commander in chief as well as the chief executive, to run secret wiretaps and searches over and above the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act.
Right. This is just exactly what James Madison warned us about.
Well, all of our founding fathers were very skeptical about the buildup of power that can accumulate in the primary authority in those days, the king, the monarchy, the prime minister, and that's why one of the brilliant divergences from the creation of governments occurred 225 years ago when we said there would be three equal branches of government at the federal level.
Right.
The executive, the Congress, and the judiciary. But now they're all ruled by one party and essentially one person. And therein lies the great difficulty that has made both the Congress unable to fulfill its oversight function, but it's also, they have also, thanks to primarily Karl Rove and Mr. Libby, have intimidated the press with only a few exceptions. You and American Radio and a few others and the New York Times editorials I find refreshing.
Although the Times did wait for a year to break the NSA wiretap story so that they wouldn't hurt Bush in the election.
They thought that they would have it both ways in that case, it seemed.
Yeah, something I'm rather concerned about. Congressman, we're speaking with Congressman John Conyers of Michigan. Congressman Conyers, you have probably more than anybody else in Congress done a really thorough analysis of the possible high crimes and misdemeanors of the Bush administration. I realize in your report you don't call them that, but I'm wondering, you were there for the impeachment proceedings against Richard Nixon.
Exactly.
And there for the impeachment proceedings against Bill Clinton.
In
your opinion, are the things that you have documented in your report and that have come out even since then, I mean today, do these constitute the high crimes and misdemeanors that the founders put into the Constitution as the basis for impeachment of the president and vice president?
They well could, several of them. But as I see my role as the most senior member of the Judiciary Committee, to be one in which I refrain from the opinions that I may have to presenting the case for everyone else to determine themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happened, Tom Hartman, is that in the course of publishing the fallacy of preemptive strikes, the ignoring of the international rules of law, including the Geneva Conventions against torture, the environmental, the Kyoto treaties, the variety of incursions that have made the utter disregard of the United Nations except when they serve a convenient purpose. All of these things, including warrantless wiretapping of American citizens on U.S. soil, constitute a huge series of either deliberate or even if unintentional consequences that have arrogated incredible new powers to the executive branch more swiftly than any other president in the history of the 42 presidents that have preceded George W. Bush. It's a stunning thing. And what it leads to, Tom,
Congressman
is the
Conyers,
assumption.
May I ask you, we have to take a break here in about 15 seconds. Can you stick around for a few minutes with us?
Unfortunately, you caught me at an improvident moment, but could I just suggest that everybody
go to conyers.com,
and they can pull this, what may ultimately become a book, free right off the Internet.
JohnConyers.com. You can get the entire thing. And you were starting to say, sir, that
I was starting to say that the impressions that people get from looking at the thing, and we're the only ones. And of course, I guess that's my role. The Constitution and its oversight resides in judiciary. We're the only ones that have pulled all this together in one place, and it's so astounding. People start thinking about, well, this means that this president, if he's not on the way to jail, he's certainly going to be the subject of massive hearings to verify this, and they've not given us one bit of help in that regard. So it builds up the calls against the president, and we're trying to figure out if the likelihood is that we prevail and have a new majority in the House of Representatives, just what our agenda should be. And and my judiciary agenda would have to be in mesh with all the other committee chairmen who also have corrections that need to be made in the course of the 110th Congress.
Congressman Conyers, just one last quick question. How is House Resolution 635, the bill that would call for an investigation into whether there have been crimes worthy of impeachment that you've sponsored, how is it going getting co-sponsors and moving that forward?
Well, I haven't looked lately, but we know that that was the reaction that I was forced to resort to, since I could get no sensible, rational communications from the executive branch on the innumerable questions that the material my brilliant judiciary staff have pulled together. Whether that kind of stonewalling will continue and force us to reexamine where we go in the 110th remains to be seen.
Yeah, and people can find out all about this at johnconyers.com. You can download the entire report. And please contact your member of Congress. The toll-free number is 888-355-3588 is a toll-free number that will get you to the switchboard for the House of Representatives. And ask your member of the House of Representatives to sign on to John Conyers, House Resolution 635. Congressman Conyers, thanks so much for being with us.
Tom Hartman, you are a blessing to the media in the United States of America.
Well, thank you, sir. I appreciate your kind words, and it's marvelous. It's an honor to have you on our program. Congressman John Conyers, johnconyers.com. You can get all the information. It's 48 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, exposing the con in conservative.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Again, I don't know where he is. I repeat what I said. I truly am not that concerned about him.
Have you forgotten?
There's an old poster out west, as I recall, that said, wanted, dead or alive.
Have you forgotten?
We'll smoke him out of his cave. And we'll get him eventually.
Have you forgotten?
Capture Bin Laden, kill him, and bring his head back in a box on dry ice.
Have you forgotten?
Basically, the president botched the response to 9/11. Should have gone right after Bin Laden.
Have you forgotten?
We should have focused on finding Bin Laden and demolishing Al-Qaeda.
Have you forgotten?
Before going down and starting a war in Iraq.
Why did we put all our military resources into Iraq, which was our number five security threat?
Have you forgotten?
Donald Rumsfeld said there were no good targets in Afghanistan. Let's bomb Iraq.
Have you forgotten?
And we said that Iraq had nothing to do with this, and that didn't seem to make much difference.
Have you forgotten?
We'll never know if we could have gotten him Bin Laden because we didn't make it a priority.
Have you forgotten?
I repeat what I said. I truly am not that concerned about him.
Have you forgotten?
Republicans, if you like that, keep going forward with these guys.
And welcome back. 54 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. A federal judge ruled today. Now, I doubt that the federal judge decided, gee, I guess I'll do this on the day that JonBenet Ramsey's killer gets caught so that nobody will notice. Maybe it's a little too much of a conspiracy theory to think that that's the case. Who knows? Who knows? Maybe she's a Republican judge. I don't know. But U.S. District Judge Anna Diggs Taylor in Detroit today ruled that George W. Bush is, in fact, well, this is my language, not hers, but is, in fact, breaking the law. Judge Taylor, in her 43-page opinion, wrote, quote, "Plaintiffs have prevailed and the public interest is clear in this matter. It is the upholding of our Constitution." In other words, George W. Bush, with his warrantless surveillance program, his spying on Americans without going to a judge or without even going to the FISA court. I mean, keep in mind, Congress, when Congress looked at this, I mean, there was this balancing act of, on the one hand, you have the need to actually, from time to time, spy on people. We all agree with that. If there are people who are planning to blow up buildings and kill people and God only knows what all, we would like to know about it. We, the people, we would all like to know about it. I'd like to know about it. Conservatives want to know about it. Liberals want to know about it. Every Americans want to know. Americans want to be safe, of course. And we want to know that we're not being spied on gratuitously. That if my phone calls are being listened into, it's because a judge has determined, based on some evidence that has been presented to that judge, that there is probable cause, to use the language of the Fourth Amendment, that there is probable cause for that judge to believe that I might be engaged in breaking some crime, breaking some law, or engaged in some crime. And on that basis, they don't have to prove it. They just have to prove that probably something's going on. They don't have to prove that something's going on to get a warrant. And Congress looked at this and said, okay, well, here's the problem. How do you go into a court and get a warrant when court proceedings are public? And so they created a secret court. And tens of thousands of times prior to Bush, the administration had gone to the secret FISA court and said, hey, we need to listen to the phone call of so-and-so. And the court said, fine, no problem. They rubber-stamped all of them, or virtually all of them. And Bush comes along, he says, we don't need no stinking court. I'm sorry, George. You've been shown up. You can JohnConyers.com. Don't forget also for John Conyers' summary of this. But this is the latest development in this ongoing saga. U.S. District Judge Anna Diggs Taylor in Detroit saying, sorry, George, you can't break the law. Can't do it anymore. And she ruled that he stopped breaking the law today. A good day for democracy. After the break, we'll be back. 57 minutes.
Listening to the Tom Hartman program, check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. The man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Uncommon Sense from the Radical Middle. Steven Slavinsky is with us. He's the author of a new book, Buck Wild, How Republicans Broke the Bank and Became the Party of Big Government. He's also the director of budget studies at the Cato Institute. Steven Slavinsky, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
Stephen, would you call yourself a conservative or a libertarian or what?
I would call myself a libertarian because I think the Republican Party doesn't represent most of what we believe here. Certainly at Cato, we're against the Iraq War, for instance, the war on drugs. We don't believe what Republicans do in terms of social policy. But on the same token, some might even argue we're more conservative on the budget topics. And that's mainly the reason I wrote my book, was to say that Republicans, specifically those elected in Congress and in the White House, have in a sense really not paid attention to their political base, or more specifically to those messages they were putting forward from 94 onward, and that is we're going to try to get the budget under control, we're going to try to balance the budget. They've really done nothing of the sort, and so that's been one of the main concerns among a lot of rank-and-file conservatives, certainly among libertarians as well.
You point out in your book that George W. Bush has, in real annual growth of total federal spending, George W. Bush is just behind LBJ, who had the Great Society and the Vietnam War at the same time and was unabashedly, hey, you know, let's spend some money, unabashedly a big spender. George W. Bush, LBJ, 5.7%, George W. Bush, 4.9%, Bill Clinton, 1.5%, even better than Reagan or Herbert Walker Bush, this is really not the GOP party of the GOP party.
No, it certainly isn't. In fact, one of the points I make in the book, which is probably more conservative, excuse me, more controversial among conservatives and Republicans than it is among libertarians, and that is the idea of divided government. The system really was set up to be a checks and balances system, the federal system we're talking about here in the U.S. It was set up not to speed things along, but to, in a sense, slow things down, make things more deliberative. One of the things we've seen with this monopoly politics on both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue, you've got Republicans not reining each other in. Instead, they're egging each other on. There's no oversight. Hearings to speak of on so many things.
Yeah, Jerry Lewis yesterday speaking out in defense of earmarks.
Well, Well, I don't,
weird does it get, right?
I'm not surprised by that. They call the appropriations the favor factory for a reason. In fact, that was Jack Abramoff's turn. He's certainly a guy who should know what he's talking about on this source. Yeah. I mean, the truth of it is, what Republicans have done is they've sort of bought into this mindset that, hey, as long as we're in control, we can assume we're the permanent majority. We don't have to listen to anyone. We can do whatever we want, and as a result, we'll start paying off all of our friends with all of these favors.
But there's an issue behind the issue. I mean, in the book, we're talking with Stephen Slavinsky. His new book is called Buck Wild. And by the way, the design of this, let me just congratulate your publisher. I got this, and it's beautiful.
Thank you. I thought it was gloriously looking. I agree.
Yeah. It looks like an old book for listeners who aren't looking at one, and it's really cool. In the book, you talk about how Barry Goldwater made a fateful decision to confront Eisenhower back in 1957. And that this was, for Goldwater, a turning point, because Eisenhower really was probably the most liberal of all the Republican presidents we've had since Abraham Lincoln. And, in fact, Eisenhower, before he decided to run as a Republican, there was a lot of speculation he was going to run as a Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the point at which Goldwater became, you know, kind of stepped out, and his Declaration of Independence, as it were, in 1957. And it really, the Republican Party has really never come back from that, have they?
I don't necessarily think so. I mean, I think there is definitely a schism in the ranks. I think you tended to see these ebbs and flows. A lot of the questions that have been put to me since the book came out was, well, were the Republicans really ever a party of small government?
I was going to say, Nixon was growing government faster than Bill Clinton did. I would say, you know, Clinton was probably the most conservative fiscally of all the presidents that we've had. At least since Herbert Hoover.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's mainly because of the idea of divided government. It sort of created this gridlock that
lowered government. Because you had to deal with a Republican Congress.
Well, that's right. And I think generally, and I present some numbers in the book that show that the system works better, meaning the U.S. system works better when you have some sort of gridlock, when
an
you
adversarial
don't have
system.
United
right.
control. Exactly.
Although I would submit to you that Clinton economically was and is a conservative.
I would say economically that's certainly true. I mean, you had NAFTA, you had capital gains tax cuts, you had all sorts of things.
Which brings us back to the bigger picture, which is the question of what kind of government do we want? And if you go back and you read Russell Kirk's 1953 book, The Conservative Mind, the one that really animated Barry Goldwater, him going in 1957, and Kirk starts out his book with Burke, you know, with Sir Edmund Burke. And you go back to Burke's writing back in the 1790s, and Kevin Phillips is writing about this recently as well.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, Kevin Phillips is writing about this in his book, The Republican Majority, back in the 1960s?
Yeah.
67, as I recall.
Yeah.
You get it that the historic conservative perspective, which, by the way, was not the Republican Party's perspective from its founding in 1856, until probably the 1870s, when the Republican Party flipped, because you look at the Republican Party platform, even of 1882, the election of 1882, and the Republican Party was a very progressive party. I mean, they were calling for suffrage of women and I mean, just all kinds of things. But the conservative movement, which took over the Republican Party in the 1880s, really is a movement of big business and a conservative elite. It's recapturing Alexander Hamilton's vision and President John Adams' vision of a government that is democratic but not too democratic, that has a governing elite that is an elite by virtue not of heredity like in England, but of merit, a meritocracy, but nonetheless a governing elite.
I would certainly say that's certainly partly true. I mean, after all, there were very, very large pro-big business forces throughout the history of the Republican Party, and obviously there is today. I think what's different about the Republican Party after Reagan versus before Reagan, or even after Goldwater to a certain extent, is that you still had a cadre of folks who were just as skeptical of government power as they are of big business power. And you had the freshman congressmen, in fact, back in 1994, were mostly motivating a lot of this. The idea that the government shouldn't be funding, for instance, corporate welfare programs. And yet congressional leaders are constantly battling for corporate welfare programs for a variety of reasons. And so
I would agree with you that Goldwater and Proxmire and others, you know, of that era were opposed to those. But I would say that Reagan and Newt and all those guys, you know, forward, that they were rhetorically opposed to government merging with corporate interests, Mussolini's definition of fascism, but that in behavior they were absolutely in bed with them.
Oh,
I mean,
certainly.
You know, Reagan, Star Wars, I mean, he was the godfather of corporate boondoggles.
Yes, sir. It's always cuts for thee, but not for me, and I think that's true. As long as you have programs that are supported by Republicans, they're going to be protected, and everyone else's programs are going to possibly get cuts, although, again, as I've said, I think you haven't seen too many cuts of any sort in anything, really. But the truth of it all is that mostly what motivates Republican leaders anymore is sort of this insular mentality. We can do whatever we want, and as long as we get plenty of money to our corporate welfare programs, that we'll be fine, and we'll be able to win the next election. And I think that's starting to crack, that's starting to turn. You're going to see a lot less people happy with what Republicans are doing on the Republican side, by the way. I think the war in Iraq being as unpopular as it is on both sides of the aisle. And the fact is that this is just sort of one of the other, I think, arrows in the quiver that we have against the current united Republican structure.
If we the people collectively, through our elected representatives, if a majority of we the people decide that we want programs like Social Security or universal Medicare, for example, a single national single-payer health program like most other industrialized countries have, I know that those are programs you oppose.
Mm-hmm.
Why shouldn't we have them?
Well, I think you've got to deal with the constitutional issues of a lot of those things, first of all, and so that would require probably changes to the Constitution, which would require a much larger...
The Constitution gives Congress the ability to appropriate funds and spend them. Doesn't put limits on what they can spend them on.
It actually does put limits on terms of what they can do in terms of power, and there's a lot of problems with delegation of authority to regulatory bodies, which is what something in a house in the healthcare system would probably have to deal with in the process. I do think, however, there's not any sort of debate going on any important issue, specifically on entitlements, for instance, because anyone on the Republican or even the Democratic side just don't seem to want to deal with that anymore. And I think, and I tend to be more of a populist in this respect, I'm more of the opinion of, well, throwing the bums out and kind of creating term limits so we force them to actually grapple with what their constituents want.
But term limits is just going to give more power to the institutional folks rather than the elected folks. I mean, we've seen that in state
true.
After state.
That's not necessarily true. If you look at what's going on in the states and you actually look at the data that's coming back from the states, you notice that lobbyists actually have less power.
Because this is what we found. We had term limits.
Every time they get new people in for
it. We had term limits here in Oregon for a while, and then they got thrown out by the Supreme Court. And, and what those term limits did was they caused the power to stop aggregating in the hands of long-term legislators who were answerable to the people and start aggregating in the hands of the bureaucrats who were telling the legislators, well, here's how we used to do it and here's how things are done. You know, it's kind of moving it around.
Well, it does seem to me that re-election rates being around 95%, like as you do at the federal level and oftentimes at the state level as well, having the people entrenched the way they are, it seems to me that's probably less of a good thing.
Well, I agree with you on that, but the solution in my mind to that is to just require that congressional districts be, you know, polygons.
Oh, I definitely agree with you there.
Yeah, okay. Stephen Slavinsky has booked Buck Wild, How Republicans Broke the Bank and Became the Party of Big Government. Interesting conversation. Stephen, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I got news. For the very best kind about trouble, and that have fallen behind about people that used to be blind till they open up their eyes to see. It's news when they begin to ask why they're poor, until the day that they die they're tired of pie in the sky and they want some security. And it's news, ain't that news, ain't that something to see. News, you talk about the news, it's mighty good news to me. I got news.
And welcome back, 21 minutes past the hour, the pill that will help you escape the matrix. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Victoria Jones, our senior excrement analysis correspondent on the line. Crap, Victoria?
That is what Deputy British Prime Minister John Prescott said about the Bush administration, according to several people who were in a meeting with him just recently. Yes.
So let me get this straight. The number two guy in the Blair administration, essentially Blair's vice president, you know, to use the American parallel.
He's the Dick Cheney.
Yeah, he's the Dick Cheney of the United Kingdom, called Bush and his programs, quote, crap, end quote.
That is absolutely correct.
And
yes,
that word in the UK has the same meaning it has here.
It has exactly the same meaning, and in fact, one of the most respected newspapers, The Independent, uses the word not only in the text of the article, but in the headline itself.
Holy cow.
Yes, indeed.
So, now I understand he's also denying that he said it now?
He's denying it, but it's rather a feeble denial, and it does seem that there are enough people at the meeting to confirm that he said it, that his denial is falling on rather deaf ears. He also has a reputation of being rather an outspoken man. He's said the, quote, crap, unquote, word in more than one other occasion within people's ears. And he said other things as well. So nobody really believes that he didn't say it.
Yeah, go ahead.
Questions were asked of Tony Snow about this morning's briefing.
Oh, really?
Yes,
and
they were.
And he replied?
Well, unfortunately, your senior correspondent was not able to get the first question in because I don't get my questions in as early as some of the other people, regrettably.
Uh-huh.
But I did get in a very interesting follow-up question. Well, basically, I put it to the... You see, what Prescott allegedly said was that he only signed on for the war on Iraq because they were promised a roadmap to peace in Palestine in return, and that the Bush administration didn't give it to them, and the Bush administration was crap on that.
I see. Interesting. And in other words, the Bush administration broke a promise to the United Kingdom.
Exactly. And as a matter of fact, Tony Blair has supposedly uttered similar sentiments, but in a different way. So I put it to Tony Snow in a very roundabout way that might not John Prescott have a point in that the roadmap doesn't seem to be going too well at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave me a lengthy lecture about how committed we were to the roadmap and that if it hadn't been for the kidnappings and Hezbollah and the fact that they're in the middle of a war, everything would be going very well.
Sort of like, you know, we were driving down the street and the map blew into the back seat and then the Coke spilled all over it and then the dog chewed a part of it, but we still have a roadmap.
Basically, yes.
Victoria, we're talking with Victoria Jones. I'm assuming that you've heard that U.S. District Judge Anna Diggs Taylor in Detroit has declared that George W. Bush is in violation of both the law and the Constitution.
This is fascinating, and you've got to wonder how long this will stand.
This law actually has provisions in it that say that people who break it will go to prison, and George W. Bush has now been declared in violation of it. What's next?
Well, I don't think he's heading for the big house somehow.
Why not?
I just don't think he's going there. He's headed for Camp David this afternoon, and I know he's got a wedding in Kennebunkport, and I don't think that those arrangements are going to be messed about with.
So the President of the United States can break the law and get away with it. We've already figured out that his number two guy, Karl Rove, his chief of staff, can break the law and get away with it, outing a CIA agent, possibly leading to the death of other CIA agents, bringing down an entire counterterrorism program, and still call himself a patriot. At what point, Victoria Jones, do you think that the American public are going to say enough already?
Well, I think to some extent they're saying that... And I think we'll see more of that in November. I mean, this very interesting AP Ipsos poll showing how far ahead Democrats are over Republicans in congressional elections. This may have changed slightly with the bombing arrest last week, but I don't know how much it will have done. And the Zogby poll again showing Democrats ahead. I suspect that there would be no reason for the president to go to prison yet anyway, because there's going to be an appeal, I'm sure, over this judge.
Oh, they'll take it to the Supreme Court.
Yeah,
I mean, but see, just like they did Hamdan and just like they did what was the other one? There was two other cases, but they lost in both of the other ones. I mean, when the Bushies took this stuff to the Supreme Court.
Right, and they're going to have to hope that they're going to win in this one.
Yeah, because...
And I've got to wonder, now, is anyone going to have to recuse themselves in this one? Is Roberts going to have to recuse himself from this? Did he not work on some of this?
Yeah, I honestly don't remember the details. But whether they recuse themselves or not, I think the law is just so clear, and Bush has so clearly broken it, that it's just, you know, he's not going to be able to wiggle out of it. I don't think that this is like a liberal judge trying to get him or something.
I'm surprised that the judge ruled this way because I'm so used to judges rolling over.
Yeah, she says it's a matter of upholding our Constitution. That's a verbatim quote from her 43-page opinion. Victoria Jones, Iowa Talk Radio News, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Victoria.
Thank you very much.
27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
It's all good. It's all right. Lord, it's always a good day when you're glad to be alive. Everything I need ain't too hard to find. Why don't waste my time complaining? Cause I don't see how I could. It's all.
And welcome back to the vast radical middle conspiracy. Take no imitations, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. In this case, I am reading from the 44-page decision by Judge Anna Taylor in Detroit just moments ago, well, maybe an hour or so ago, ruling against George W. Bush. She says, in this case, this is the NSA spy program, the president, in this case, the president has acted indisputably as FISA forbids, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. FISA is the expressed statutory policy of our Congress. The presidential power, therefore, was exercised at its lowest ebb and cannot be sustained. She goes on to, she then quotes the Youngstown case and several other cases, the Massawi case and the Clinton versus Jones case, to point out that the separation of powers is real. And she says, in this case, if the teachings of Youngstown are law, and of course they are, I mean, she's asserting that they are as a judge, the separation of powers doctrine has been violated. The president undisputedly has violated the provisions of FISA for a 5-year period. She says, these secret authorization orders must, like the executive order in that case, fall. They violate the separation of powers ordained by the very Constitution of which this president is a creature. It's amazing. I mean, she just lays this thing out and just says, that's it, sorry. It's remarkable. I'm just now reading this ruling. In Judge Anna Diggs Taylor, she says, there are no hereditary kings in America and no powers not created by the Constitution. Therefore, she says, all the president's inherent powers must derive from the Constitution and he's acting in violation of it. In the Eastern District Court of Michigan, of the United States, the Federal District Court, Eastern District of Michigan, ACLU versus the NSA, et cetera. The Honorable Anna Diggs Taylor. This is a big deal. This is a big deal. Yeah, they found the guy who has confessed to having killed JonBenet Ramsey. But this is a big deal. And there's a lot that's going to... I mean, the finding that the President of the United States has broken the law. This is just incredible. We're trying to track down somebody from the ACLU.
No luck yet.
No luck yet. Okay. I would love to get their feedback, their thought on this. She says, first, it must be remembered that both Title III and the FISA, the Federal Intelligence Surveillance Act, permit delayed applications for warrants after surveillance has begun. Also, the case law has long permitted law enforcement action to proceed in cases in which the lives of officers or others are threatened in cases of hot pursuit, border searches, school locker searches, or where emergency situations exist. In other words, he has no excuse here. She goes on to say, indeed, in Zweibon, this is another case that she's citing, Judge Wright enumerates a number of defendants' practical arguments here. and finds after long and careful analysis that none constitutes adequate justification for exemption from the requirements of either FISA or the Fourth Amendment. It is noteworthy in this regard that defendants have sought no congressional amendments that would remedy practical difficulty. Now that's where it gets strange. Now, I'll tell you about that in just a second. This is what Arlen Specter is up to. But anyhow, she says, you know, there's no law that gives Bush the authority to do this. She says, as long ago as the Youngstown case, the Truman administration argued that the cumbersome procedures required to obtain warrants made the process unworkable. The Youngstown court made short shift of that argument, and it appears the present defendant's need for speed and agility is equally weightless. The Supreme Court in the Keith, as well as the Hamdi cases, has attempted to offer helpful solutions to the delay problem, but all to no avail. Here's the conclusion. For all of the reasons outlined above, this court is constrained to grant to plaintiffs the partial summary judgment requested and holds that the TSP, the Terrorist Surveillance Program, violates the APA, the Separation of Powers Doctrine, the First and Fourth Amendments of the United States Constitution, and the statutory law. I'm reading here from the decision, the actual decision today. Defendant's motion to dismiss the final claim of data mining is granted, because litigation of that claim would require violation of defendant's state secrets privilege. Okay, so Bush got a little bit here. They dismissed the data mining claim, but on the big one here, the permanent injunction of the TSP, the Terrorist Surveillance Program, the permanent injunction, in other words, permanently stopping Bush from spying on you and me and anybody else in the United States without a warrant. The permanent injunction of the TSP requested by plaintiffs is granted, inasmuch as each of the factors required to be met to sustain such an injunction have indisputably been met. The irreparable injury necessary to warrant injunctive relief is clear, as the First and Fourth Amendment rights of plaintiffs are violated by the TSP. The irreparable injury conversely sustained by defendants under this injunction may be rectified by compliance with our Constitution and or statutory laws amended if necessary. Let me translate that from legalese into English. The Bush administration is claiming that if they're forced to stop their so-called terrorist surveillance program, their warrantless surveillance program, they're breaking the FISA law. If they're forced to stop breaking the law, it will cause them irreparable harm. And the judge says this irreparable harm may be rectified, can be solved, this problem can be solved, by compliance with our Constitution and or statutory law. In other words, you don't want the United States to be harmed? Fine, follow the law! Plaintiffs have prevailed, she writes, and the public interest is clear in this matter. It is the upholding of our Constitution. And then she quotes from Justice Warren, 1967, in the case U.S. versus Robel. This is how she closes the case. Before the words, "it is so ordered," which are the last four words in the decision. As Justice Warren wrote in U.S. versus Robel, 389 U.S. 258, 1967, implicit in the term national defense is the notion of defending those values and ideas which set this nation apart. It would indeed be ironic if, in the name of national defense, we would sanction the subversion of those liberties which makes the defense of this nation worthwhile. End of quote. That's incredible. That's Judge Anna Diggs Taylor, United States District Judge, this morning in Detroit, ruling that the Bush administration is clearly not just in violation of the law, but in violation of the Constitution. Now, when you go back and you read the Federalist Papers and you read the writings of the founders about why and when and under what circumstances an impeachment would be an appropriate remedy for misbehavior on the part of the president and the vice president, they are really quite clear and unambiguous. There is only one job the president is given in the Constitution. You'll find it in Article 2. Well, actually, yeah, fundamentally it boils down to one job. I mean, they lay out, you know, he can nominate folks to fill offices when people are not available, and he can, you know, quack. But really, here's what it boils down to. This is Section 1, Article 2 of the Constitution, which is about the executive branch. Article 1 is the legislative branch, because that's the most important. It's closest to the people. Article 2 is the executive branch. Article 3, the judiciary. Right. Article 1 of Section 1, Paragraph 8. Before he enter on the execution of his office, he shall take the following oath or affirmation. I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. End of quote. From the Constitution. In other words, Bush's only job is to defend the Constitution. And here, this judge, this federal judge, has concluded that he is not only not protecting the Constitution, he's violating the Constitution. And if you read the writings of the founders, they make it very clear that's an impeachable offense. Not having sex in the Oval Office, that's not an impeachable offense. Come on, give me a break. But violating the Constitution? I mean, if there's anything that rises to the level of an impeachable offense, it has to be violating the Constitution. Now, certainly these guys are going to take, you know, the Bush administration is going to take this thing to the Supreme Court. But this is a very well-written decision, citing dozens of other previous cases. I mean, she builds this case so carefully and methodically. This is brilliant. If Bush isn't impeached, if not imprisoned as a result of this, I'll be amazed. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
So that's how it is. That's what we got. And if the president wants to admit it or not, you can read it in the paper, read it on the wall, hear it on the wind if you're listening at all. Get out of that limo and look us in the eye. Call us on a cell phone, tell us all why. In Dayton, Ohio, or Portland, Maine, or a cotton gin out on the Great High Plains. It's done closed down along with the school and the hospital and the swimming pool. Dust devils dance in the noonday heat. There's rats in the alley and trash in the street. Gang graffiti on a boxcar door. We can't make it here anymore.
No, but we can take this country back and make it a nation where we can make it here anymore. Welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. I am reading this. This is hot off the press. You can get it at the ACLU website, aclu.org. There's a PDF of the 44-page decision by the judge in this case. The decision against George W. Bush, concluding that the Bush administration has not only broken the law, a law, by the way, which has criminal penalties. Keep in mind, it was Nixon's participation in breaking the law that caused him to have to leave office. He was going to be impeached, and he knew it, which is why he resigned. It was Clinton's breaking a technicality in the law, lying to a grand jury about whether or not he had sex with Monica Lewinsky. And how you define sex, I suppose. It was Clinton breaking a technicality in the law that caused the House of Representatives to vote to impeach him. Here now, a federal judge. Now, Clinton had not been convicted of breaking the law. There was not a court case in which, I mean, the Bar Association pulled his license to practice law, but he was not convicted of the crime. To the best of my knowledge, unless I'm missing something, maybe my memory is incomplete, but I'm quite sure he was never prosecuted for lying to the grand jury. It was simply obvious. And I would say that that prosecution actually was the impeachment hearing in the House of Representatives. But here now you have George W. Bush going before a court. It's actually the NSA, but it's the defendants of the National Security Agency, the Central Security Service, and Lieutenant General Keith B. Alexander in his official capacity as Director of the National Security Agency and Chief of Central Security Service. Okay, that's the defendants. But she's talking about the president here. And it's the more I read this thing, the more it's just a jaw dropper. Talking about the Fourth Amendment. She quotes the Fourth Amendment. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall be issued but upon probable cause. Okay. Et cetera. And then she says, this amendment was specifically profound and ratified with the memory of Entick versus Carrington, 1765 in mind. This is 1760. This is a case from before the United States was even formed that led to the creation of the Fourth Amendment in 1791 that the Bill of Rights was ratified? I believe it was. She says, Justice Douglas, in his concurrence in the Keith case, also noted the significance of Entick in our history. Now, this is Justice Douglas. He says, for it was such excesses as the use of general warrants and the writs of assistance that led to the ratification of the Fourth Amendment. In Entick versus Carrington, decided in 1765, one finds a striking parallel to the executive warrants utilized here. The Secretary of State had issued general executive warrants to his messengers, authorizing them to roam about and seize libelous material and libelants of the sovereign. In other words, people who are speaking out against the king. Entick, a critic of the crown, was the victim of one such general search, during which his seditious publications were impounded. He brought a successful damage action for trespass against the messengers. The verdict was sustained on appeal. Now, this was against George III. I'm talking King George III of England, not the third George to be president of the United States, George Bush. Lord Camden wrote, again, I'm quoting from the Keith case. This is Justice Douglas being quoted by Judge Taylor. Lord Camden wrote that if such sweeping tactics were validated, then the secret cabinets and bureaus of every subject in the kingdom would be thrown open to the search and inspection of a messenger, whatever the Secretary of State shall think fit to charge or even suspect a person to be the author, printer, or publisher of a seditious libel. She says, in a related and similar proceeding, the same judge who presided over Entick's appeal held for another victim of the same despotic practice, saying to enter a house, man's house by virtue of a nameless warrant in order to procure evidence is worse than the Spanish Inquisition. This is a case in 1765! She says, the tyrannical invasions described and assailed in Entick, Huckle, and Wilkes practices, which were also endured by the colonists, have been recognized as the primary abuses which ensured the warrant clause a prominent place in our Bill of Rights. I mean, this is, end of quote from Justice Douglas in the Keith case being quoted here today in the case of ACLU versus NSA in saying they violated the Fourth Amendment. The Bush administration has broken the law. Will somebody please impeach this guy? 57 minutes past the hour. When we come back on the other side of the hour, Brad Friedman's going to be with us talking about what's going on with voting machines all around the country. And Carol Porter, running for Congress, our Taking Our Country Back candidate for the day. We'll be back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Brad Friedman is with us, www.bradblog.com and velvetrevolution.us. Hey, Brad.
Hey, Tom. How are you, my friend?
I am absolutely great, but I'll get better. I hope you're well.
I'm doing all right. Traveling around the country here for the last several weeks, doing a lot of events, speaking events, and otherwise trying to take a minute or two off the blog, but I'm not being very successful at that, Tom.
Well, I'm curious what's going on with the Busby-Bilray race. You have been at the forefront of pointing out that these voting machines in this race in San Diego had sleepovers, and that there has been some, you know, there's been some questions here. Although Busby has just said enough already.
Well, she has been saying enough already from the beginning. Her initial statements really haven't changed much, unfortunately, when she told everyone that she had no concerns about the vote counting because there was hundreds of people from both parties there on election night observing the counting, and they didn't see anything unusual, which, you know, it indicates she really doesn't understand the problem here. You could have a million people watching the vote counting on election night, and if these systems were gamed, you would never see it, and that's the concern.
Yeah, it's like, you know, watch my computer and tell me what's going on in the silicon inside it.
Well, you know, and that's one of the problems. We're seeing this all over the country, and when it comes to the Democrats, really, in particular, who I think they think they're out there keeping an eye on what's going on at the polls by showing up on election day and making sure there's no monkey business. What they don't seem to realize is that the dirty deed could well be done prior to election day. And that's why those sleepovers, look, when they sent those machines home with poll workers in violation of both state and federal requirements for weeks at a time prior to the election, it takes only 1 or 2 minutes to completely game those systems. And if you can affect one system, it can then affect every other machine in the race. So the security is important, and that is what the Busby-Bilbray election contest, and it's now officially been filed an election contest against that election, and calling on the judge either to throw out the results because of the security violations and the fact that votes were illegally cast on what were decertified machines, or in the alternative, call for a full hand count of all of the ballots and paper trails in that race, presuming the chain of custody documents for those ballots at this time, here we are, what, 2 or 3 months later, is somewhat intact. And, of course, now we're hearing that there may not even be chain of custody documents for those ballots and voting machines.
Well, we're also 2 or 3 months short of the November election, in which Busby is again running against Bilray.
Well, that's
And I would suspect that her efforts are entirely devoted to beating him in the election. Any sense of what the polls are showing or how she's doing so far?
Well, what I'm hearing is that Bilbray is actually doing better, as expected. He's doing better against Busby than he had been previously because, look, he's going to have 6 months of incumbency at that point.
Right.
And, you know, I've spoken to her, and I don't think she understands that, in my opinion, election integrity is the crossover issue of all crossover issues. You know, you come out, you stand for electoral integrity, security at the ballot, and call for, you know, every vote to be counted accurately, and in such a way that it can actually be proven to be accurate. And I think you're going to bring in people from both parties, from all parties, let me say, Democratic, Republican, Green, Libertarian, whatever. You know, I think Americans are sick and tired of what they're hearing about these voting machines, and they will stand up and stand behind a candidate who stands for protecting their vote.
To the best of my knowledge, at this moment, we're talking with Brad Friedman, bradblog.com and velvetrevolution.us. To the best of my knowledge, Brad, the only member of Congress who has at least personally told me that they think we should simply go back to paper until we get all this stuff sorted out is Bernie Sanders.
Mm.
Do you know of any others?
No, you know, I don't. And I think that's a courageous call to call for that. And I guess Bernie is independent. So.
Yeah, he's not a Democrat. He's not a Republican. He's an independent. He's running for the U.S. Senate, and he said that a number of times on my radio program.
Yeah.
He's on here every Friday. And I don't think I suspect sometimes my listeners don't realize what a big statement that is.
Oh, it's huge. I mean, look, both of these parties are really in complete denial about what is going on, and they've gone to these machines. They use the scam of the phony problems, really, that we had back in 2000 to push these machines on folks.
It's the hanging chads.
Right, exactly. What a disaster. We actually have to count them. And then, right. Of course, they go to court, to the Supreme Court, to keep these votes from being counted. That was the problem. And I should also mention that the whole problem began back in 2000 when a Diebold optical scan machine registered negative 16,000 votes for Al Gore in Volusia County. That's why he conceded back then, and when they discovered the problem, that's when he unconceded. And of course, the solution to dealing with that problem with this Congress was to encourage, to the tune of $3.8 billion in tax money, all
more of those very machines.
Move to those very machines. And of course, that was Bob Ney of Ohio, who's now on his way out, the soon-to-be-indicted Bob Ney, who was the one who pushed that Help America Vote Act through, along with the help of Diebold lobbyists who were his former chief of staff.
Yeah. We just have a couple of minutes here, Brad Friedman, bradblog.com and velvetrevolution.us. What's going on? Just give me some bullet points here. Illinois, California, Ohio. What's going on around the country?
Well, we just had a report out by an independent group who took a look at the Ohio primaries from May 2nd, and they found in Ohio that the vote counts did not match up. The paper ballots didn't match the paper trails, didn't match the memory card. Nothing matched, and some 10% of the so-called voter verified paper audit trail was either blank or didn't exist or was wrong. I mean, we've got a mess on our hands, and that was the first election that Cuyahoga County had brought in these new Diebold touchscreen machines. So we're seeing problems like that in every state right now in the country. I'm heading up this afternoon to Chicago, where the DNC, you remember them, they're having their annual meeting, and I've actually been invited to address them for a few minutes this week. And
that's marvelous. Well, you know, Howard Dean is the only person that I know of who has hacked a Diebold machine live and on television. He did it when he was the guest host for Topic A with Tina Brown. Him and Bev Harris sat there. I've got the audio of it. I play it from time to time.
Yeah.
And you know, every time you play it for a Republican, their eyes bug out. You know,
exactly.
The only politician in history to have hacked a Diebold machine live on TV is Howard Dean, and they go, Howard Dean, you're kidding.
Well, that's right. He, I believe, gets it. The trick now is getting the rest of the Democratic Party to get it, so I hope to knock some sense into them this weekend. In the meantime, it's up to the citizens, like those folks down there in San Diego in the Busby Bilbray race, to challenge these elections on their own, to let the people know about what's going on. To that end, I would encourage your listeners, if they could, to stop by velvetrevolution.us and donate a few dollars, if you can, towards this legal effort, because it's entirely funded by the citizens, at least until we can get the DNC to realize what's going on and try to help us out in this fight for electoral accountability down there.
Right. Salon.com now has an article about the six states that they plan on stealing this fall.
Yep.
We know about Ohio in the 2004 election, Georgia in the 2002 election, Florida in the 2000 election. Now they have all of them.
They got them all. And
So what's the strategy? What should people do in November of 2006?
Well, one thing is you don't wait till November of 2006, and that's why, you know, I hate to go back again to the Busby Bilbray thing, but that is not about that San Diego race. It's not about Busby. That is about saying right here and now we are not going to tolerate that kind of behavior come November. You have to fight these things now.
No, I understand that. Yeah. And yet, Brad, you have to acknowledge the reality that the machines are not going to go away in the next 90 days or 100 days or however many days it is till Election Day. And a lot of people think that the solution is to vote an absentee ballot. The reality is that an awful lot of absentee ballots never get counted. It seems to me the only two things that can be done are, number one, educate people about the danger of these machines, and number two, show up in such overwhelming numbers that even if they rig the machines and try and steal the election, we still win.
Yes, and is there
any alternative I'm missing?
I would add number three, show up at those polls with cameras, with videotapes, talk to your elections officials, let them know we are watching, make public records requests, be the watchdog that the media and the political parties are not being. It is up to everyone listening to this show to protect their own democracy.
And you can find out more about it over at velvetrevolution.us. Brad Friedman, bradblog.com. Brad, thanks for being with us today.
Always great, Tom. Thanks.
And for the great work you're doing. I salute you, my friend.
Thank you, sir.
16 minutes past the hour. After the break, taking our country back with progressive congressional candidates. Stay tuned. Might be your district.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Now I can understand why you were hot, 'cause Bin Laden never did get caught. So you said we had Saddam to blame, tried to tell us it was all the same. Now the years roll by and our kids keep dying. You don't even have a plan to bring them home. Those WMDs you promised on TV, admit it, you figured it wrong, so I'm taking my country back.
Yes, indeed, my friends, it's time to take our country back. 21 minutes past the hour, welcome back. We asked Bernie Sanders a month or so ago, what should folks do? We've got $25, $50, $100, a couple hundred dollars. They want to help out. They want to get involved in politics. But maybe their local political race is in the bag. It looks like they got a safe candidate. Or, how should they throw money to the party? He said, no, find candidates around the country, progressive candidates, good people who you can independently support. And so every week we bring on to this program a candidate that we believe is worthy of your support. Today, it's Carol Porter, Carol Shea Porter, and her website is carolforcongress.com, C-A-R-O-L, forcongress.com. She's running for the United States Congress in New Hampshire's 1st District, which is currently represented by Jeb Bradley, that congressional seat. There's a primary September 12th. Carol, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Great to have you with us. What do you see as the big issues in your race, Carol Porter?
Well, what I keep saying to people, and I actually hyphenate my name, it's Shea Porter, but what I say to people is that no matter what this government's telling us, no matter what they talk about with the stock market and industry doing so well, the people in this district understand that when Friday night comes, it's hard to find money for pizza. And they know that something's gone very, very wrong for what I call the bottom 99%, that the jobs are tougher to come by, the pay is low, their property taxes are high, their gas prices are high, and in this district, people have to drive a lot. We don't have mass transit. So they're being impacted on many levels, and so I think that what we're looking at here is a really major sea change in how people are viewing the Republican administration.
Indeed. Carol Shea Porter, carolforcongress.com, the website. And Carol, first of all, the 1st District of New Hampshire encompasses what area?
It goes from Manchester, which is, a large city, and it crosses all the way on the eastern border to the seacoast, and then they sort of divide it north and south. So we have a good chunk of what we call the North Country. So we just have two districts in the whole state. Mm-hmm. So there are two progressive candidates running in mm-hmm. one in each district, and then a few others
in the Democratic primaries.
Yes,
and you're one of those two progressive candidates.
Right, and the other one's running by himself in the 2nd district.
Uh huh. Okay.
So I'm the most progressive in our district.
Great. CarolForCongress.com, the website. We're talking with Carol Shea Porter, and Carol, what's the solution that you would propose to the economic problems that we're facing? Or what are these solutions?
Well, I tell people that we won't have complete change until President Bush and the Republican leadership leaves. But if we can bring about a big change in Congress this November, and and I'm talking about a big change, I'm talking about a posse of reformers there, we are going to be able to address these issues and stop some of what's happening. For example, we know that those tax cuts for the very rich have caused about 48% of this deficit. So we've got to deal with that issue. And we have so many across the board that will have to be addressed. The health care. We have to deal with health care. I'm calling for Medicare for all. And the majority of Americans are with us on these issues, as you know.
Yes.
It's
amazing.
It is amazing. The American public is in front of Congress on these issues, the war in Iraq, the deficit that we're facing, which is putting us in critical danger. That's endangering our national security. Borrowing money from communist China is really a bad idea. It amounts to having the parent ask the kid every Friday night for allowance.
Yeah.
We have to go to money, you know, from China.
Well, and that's actually, you know, in the same family. I mean, that's an imperfect metaphor in as much as China is the only country that I know of in the last 5 years that has had a major military official threaten to bomb 100 of our countries with nuclear missiles and not be reprimanded for it by his own government and still be in power.
Right.
We
don't have any moral authority there.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're running out of time here to turn this around.
But this
district is aware, and there's a great buzz now about, you know, what we're going to do in November and how to make real significant change. So it'll be on several levels. It'll have to be dealing with the deficit. It'll have to be dealing with the war in Iraq and with health care and jobs and energy. We have no energy program right now, none, and people are asking for one, and they're tying, obviously, energy in with the environment.
Yeah. Well, Cheney would tell you that we have an energy program. It's called Corporate Welfare for Oil Companies.
Exactly.
you're right. On the issues and civil liberties on your website, you start out, the men who wrote our Constitution were no strangers to danger. We have just 20 seconds left or so, but give us a shot at civil liberties.
Well, we're in danger of losing our civil liberties. And because they've played on this fear factor for so long, which, by the way, they don't deserve to claim that they're the ones who protect us because they haven't implemented anything from the 9/11 Commission. It's all illusion. But what they're doing is they've convinced Americans to spy on one another and to turn over radio records and all the other awful things that are happening. And I think Americans are catching on that we are not going to go timidly into this world. We're supposed to be bold and brave, and we're supposed to, you know, get out there and not give up. Civil liberties are very rights that make the rest of the world envious.
Carol Shea Porter, carolforcongress.com. 27
yes.
minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
If I told you once, must have told you twice. The last thing you're looking for is their advice. The truth be told, it's just a pack of lies. The last thing you're looking for is their advice.
And welcome back. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. And time for our activism alert for the day. If you're not sure what to do, here's an idea.
Mayday, oh, we got it. Mayday, long ago. They got the guns, but we got the numbers. Gonna win, yeah, we're taking over. Come on!
Yeah, step by step here. We've got to take this country back, and here's a good starting point. Reclaiming the word democratic to describe the party of that name. Believe it or not, the Republicans have succeeded in large part as a consequence of Frank Luntz and Newt Gingrich, although this goes back way before that. Joe McCarthy used to refer to the Democratic Party as the Democrat Party, always emphasizing the rat part. But it was really Newt Gingrich and Frank Luntz who said, do this all the time. And got all the Republicans marching in lockstep. So they always refer to the Democrat Party. There's no such thing as a Democrat Party. It's the Democratic Party. And yet now even the media is beginning to refer to the Democratic Party as if it had a new name. Here's just a montage. This from Media Matters for America. You can find all the clips over at their website. But these are just figures in the media saying Democrat Party and not being corrected or them being correspondents themselves.
Democrat
primary.
Democrat
primary. Democrat party. Democrat primary.
Democrat Congress.
There's no such thing as any of those. Democrat is a word to describe a person who is a member of the Democratic Party. But see, the Republicans don't want it to be called the Democratic Party because that sounds too democratic. This is all about subtle psychological stuff. So, your activism suggestion, our activism alert for the day, to get out and get active, is the next time you hear some bozo on television or the radio use the phrase Democrat Party, and they don't get corrected by the person who's on with them, including a Democrat. I've seen Donna Brazile, for example, on TV sitting next to a Republican who goes, well, the Democrat Party. And she doesn't say, excuse me, it's not the Democrat Party, it's the Democratic Party. She just sits there and listens. You just want to shake these people. Go, wake up, don't you see what they're doing? So anyway, the next time you hear that happen, contact them. Contact CNN or contact MSNBC or contact the you can find their website, you can find their email address, you can call them up. If there's a Democrat on the program with a Republican, and that Democrat allows their party to be referred to as the Democrat Party rather than the Democratic Party, contact that Democrat and say, hey, listen, start talking back to these guys, would you? Pretty straightforward stuff. So if you're not sure what to do today or in the upcoming days, there's a starting point for you. Now, in the last hour, we were talking about the ACLU versus NSA federal court decision, and I was sharing with you pieces of the judge's ruling in this case, U.S. District Court Judge Anna Diggs Taylor, in which she says that the NSA and the executive branch, by implication, the President of the United States, George W. Bush, have violated the Constitution, have violated the separation of powers doctrine, have violated the law, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the FISA Act, which, by the way, has criminal penalties. Now, the specific defendant in this case was not George Bush. It was General Alexander. You'll recall the guy, the head of the NSA, has just been found guilty, apparently, of violating the law. Of course it will be appealed. But here's where it gets even weirder. And I want to share, you know, some more parts of this thing with you as we go through this last 20, 30 minutes here of the program. More parts of this ruling, because it's a shocker. It's worth reading. Go to ACLU.org, and you can download the entire 44-page decision and just, you know, flip to the last 20 pages of it or so. The first 15, 20 pages, she basically recaps their arguments. The last 20 pages or so, she just says, here's what I think, and just nails these guys to the wall. So what are the Republicans going to do? Here you have a federal judge saying that the Bush administration is criminally in violation of the law. And by the way, Bill Clinton, they impeached him. They impeached him for lying to a grand jury about whether or not he had sex with Monica Lewinsky. And, I mean, there was not even a court case about this. The Arkansas Supreme Court suspended his law license in April of 2000. He agreed to a 5-year suspension, paid a $25,000 fine on January 19th, 2001. In October of the following year, the U.S. Supreme Court again suspended his law license and gave him 40 days to convince them he shouldn't be disbarred permanently, so he surrendered his law license. Clinton is no longer a lawyer. He paid a penalty for breaking the law. Bush breaking the law? Any penalty? Will he be impeached like Clinton was? He doesn't have a law license to surrender. He wouldn't know the, you know, he doesn't know the, obviously he doesn't know the law. So what are the Republicans going to do? Well, here's what they're going to do. They're going to pass a law. Arlen Specter is rolling this thing out. They're going to call it a compromise. They're going to say, oh yeah, we'll compromise with the Democrats. We'll give a little, they'll give a little. but it's not a compromise. It is a complete rollover. As CNN's White House correspondent Ed Henry reports, you can read this over at thinkprogress.org. This ruling, if anything, could really provide a spark for Republican Senator Arlen Specter, the Senate Judiciary Chairman, who's been critical of this program. This is the Spy on Americans Without a Warrant program, and has been trying to craft some sort of compromise legislation on the Hill that could give the administration the cover it feels it needs to push this program forward while also trying to appease Democrats a bit in terms of the legality of the program where you need warrants. Okay, well, that's nice, Ed. Ed Henry, usually taking the Republican position on CNN, if you've noticed. I mean, he's been making me crazy lately. He comes on TV with these repeating the Republican talking points, and I'm you little weasel! It's just making me crazy. It is not a compromise. It is not providing cover. This is rolling over. As they note over at thinkprogress.org, nothing in the Specter legislation requires the Attorney General to obtain court approval before engaging in electronic surveillance. It makes it optional. Right now, the Bush administration is required to get a warrant before they can spy on you or me or anybody else. And if they think that we're committing a crime that they need to know about right now and they don't have time to get a warrant, they have 3 days to get a warrant in a special secret court that has issued tens of thousands of warrants without any problem at all. Under Arlen Specter's legislation, it's optional. You can get a warrant, Mr. Bush, if you want to, or you can choose not to. That doesn't sound to me like a compromise. Section 801 of the Specter bill includes the following statement, quote, "Nothing in this act shall be construed to limit the constitutional authority of the president to collect intelligence with respect to foreign powers and agents of foreign powers," end quote. In other words, the president can do any kind of end run he wants around the law, around the Constitution, around FISA, because this legislation says, oh, he's got all the power, absolute power, to collect intelligence. And three, the Specter compromise scraps the individualized suspicion standard required under the Fourth Amendment. So this so-called compromise that Specter is promoting isn't even constitutional. It spits in the face of the founders of this country. Well, what do you expect? He's a Republican. Arlen Specter's the guy who came up with the single bullet theory when he was the counsel to the House Select Committee on Assassinations. It was Arlen Specter's idea that bullet paused 1.3 seconds in midair before making a left turn. No, I'm serious. He was rewarded for that by a seat in the United States Senate. So anyhow, here's Arlen Specter. It scraps the individualized suspicion standard required under the Fourth Amendment, instead allowing the FISA court to authorize the entire program. So under his legislation, anybody can be spied on. Anytime, anywhere in the United States, simply because the president decides he wants to. And Specter has the gumption, the gall, to call this a compromise? I mean, this is so bogus, it's unbelievable. But I'm telling you, this is how they're going to try and get around this. They're going to take this thing to the Supreme Court. They're going to drag it out as long as they can. And who knows? Maybe if they can pack the court, maybe just one more. You got Pat Roberts out there praying that Kennedy is going to die or Ginsburg will die. They could pack the court, or, you know, if Specter passes his law, 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So you think you can tell heaven from hell, blue skies from pain, Can you tell a green field from a cold steel rail? A smile from a veil.
Welcome to the real free speech zone, my friends. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. No pass from the RNC required. No barbed wire fences. All are welcome. Welcome back to our program. 866-440-8466, our telephone number. And I'm going to pick up your calls in just a second. First, though, let's check out what's going on with the U.S. occupation of Iraq.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lights in the balance.
The following are security incidents in Iraq reported today, Thursday, as of 1,000 hours, or 1,000 hours GMT. Dateline Suwayra. Bodies of six blindfolded civilians with their hands bound and with multiple gunshot wounds were retrieved from the Tigris River. Baghdad, at least three people were killed and 26 wounded when a roadside bomb exploded in a market in Sadr City. In Dakuk, a roadside bomb exploded in that town, killing two civilians and wounding a third. In Balad, one Iraqi soldier securing oil fields was found dead with 13 gunshot wounds to the head a day after he was kidnapped in that city. In Mosul, Lieutenant Colonel Abdullah Abdul Karim of the Mosul Police Department was gunned down. In Fallujah, gunmen killed a policeman in that city. In Mumadia, an Iraqi interpreter working on a U.S. military base was killed by gunmen. In Anbar province, one U.S. soldier died on Wednesday from combat wounds. In Mogadia, several mortars landed in a market near a Shiite mosque in that town, wounding 21 people, police said. In Sinjar, nine people were wounded, including four civilians, when a suicide car bomber targeted Kurdish security forces and blew himself up. In Baghdad, three policemen were wounded when a car bomb exploded in Mansour district. And in Mumadia, a roadside bomb exploded near a gas station, wounding two civilians. In addition, Senator Barack Obama told a town hall audience in Gallatin County, Illinois, quote, "Enemies in Iran and North Korea, along with terrorist groups bent on doing the United States harm, are getting stronger while the U.S. is bogged down in Iraq." He referred to the war in Iraq as a, quote, "dumb war," end quote. Meanwhile, Tony Snow is coming out and saying, no, Bush, he's not frustrated with what's going on. Everything's just fine, thank you very much. The New York Times quoted people who were in a meeting with Bush, a recent meeting with Bush and Iraq scholars, a panel of Iraq scholars. And the New York Times said, quote, "I sensed a frustration with lack of progress in the bigger picture of Iraq. Generally, we continue to lose a lot of lives if we continue to sap our budget," said one person who attended a meeting. Another person said, "I think he was frustrated about why 10,000 Shiites would go into the streets and demonstrate against the United States." Here's Tony Snow's so-called response to this.
A number of times at the top of the piece, which is that the president is frustrated. He's frustrated that the new Iraqi government and the Iraqi people have not shown greater support for the American mission. All the participants said that did not reflect the meeting they attended.
Right.
A sense of frustration on the lack of progress on the bigger picture of Iraq generally. Again, all of those in attendance said that did not reflect their characterization.
Right.
And a paragraph that said the president had expressed frustration that Iraqis had not come to appreciate the sacrifices the United States has made in Iraq and was puzzled as to how a recent anti-American rally in support of Hezbollah in Baghdad could draw such a large crowd. That was unanimously rejected as well.
Right. Yeah, Tony Snow doing for the White House what he used to do for Fox News. Spinning. Dawn in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Dawn, thanks for calling. What's up?
Well, I was just calling to point out a word that is in the opinion.
Uh-huh. Oh, you're talking about, we're talking now about Judge Anna Diggs Taylor's, U.S. District Court Judge Anna Diggs Taylor's ruling that the administration is in violation of both the law and the Constitution in their spy program.
Exactly.
Right, okay.
Right, and you were concentrating on the end of the opinion, but I was reading the whole thing, and toward the end of the second section, on page 15, the judge says that the defendant's argument that they can't defend the case without the use of classified information is disingenuous. And I thought I'd point that out because that's a word that's not really tossed out there lightly.
Yeah, that's a very serious word. Here's the sentence. Consequently, the court finds defendants' arguments that they cannot defend this case without the use of classified information to be disingenuous and without merit. That's a very strong statement.
Yes.
Wow. Thank you for pointing that out to me.
Yep.
Dawn, appreciate it. Great. Thank you. Thank you for calling. This is an amazing ruling. I mean, I'm telling you, you've got to go ACLU.org. And you can just download the PDF, print it out, and read it. It is not hard reading. It is really some amazing reading. I was sharing with you the parts about the Fourth Amendment, the violations of the Fourth Amendment. She goes on to say, she talks about how back in 1756, there was a court case, the Entick case, Entick versus Carrington, in British courts that led to the Fourth Amendment. Because, you know, this guy, and she goes on to say, the Fourth Amendment accordingly was adopted to ensure that executive abuses of the power to search would not continue in our new nation. It took 230 years for us to roll back the Fourth Amendment. Are we going to let it stand? I sure hope not. It is time for us to stand up to this administration and say no. Coming up on tomorrow's program, Bernie Sanders will be here, Brunch with Bernie, and John Zogby is going to drop by. On the latest breaking poll, should be a fascinating conversation, plus your calls and the news of the day, the Tom Hartman program. Remember, my friends, activism begins with you. Get out there, get active. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.